You're listening to DraftKings Network.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family-owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB, the CV. Copyright 2024, Proximo. Jersey City, New Jersey. Please drink responsibly.
Well, the ship is a wreck. Shit stains the deck as Michael Hollow's fellas make more. And Billy is a worry that he's got the scurvy because Chris ate all the limes in store. Pirate radio with the ship and crew. We got wind in our sails and the sky is blue. There's a devil up our nose, so much work to do. For the Pirate Radio.
Welcome everybody to the Local Hour. David Sampson, as always, joins us on Thursday. Make sure to check out his podcast, Nothing Personal with David Sampson. Follow him on Twitter at David P. Sampson. Amin Alhassan and Dan Levitard scheduled to join us within this Local Hour. David, I went to a Marlins game over the weekend, and I went to a Marlins game over the weekend because Derek Jeter's strong statement about the situation in Georgia. Now, I thought everybody would follow Derek Jeter's lead. Wasn't exactly the case. So Derek Jeter is pretty much on an island in terms of powerful statements from Major League Baseball execs. And you could be accused of being critical of Derek Jeter. Obviously, it's a sordid past between you two. But I thought this was a very good look for Derek Jeter. And it resulted in me going into my own wallet and paying money to see the Marlins.
I can't believe that's what it took for you to take your family to a Marlins game. You have baseball right in your backyard and you require a statement on something that happened in Georgia for you to start making memories with your daughter. Can you just explain the thought process that enters your mind that was the moment? It wasn't Starling Marte. It wasn't the great spring training winning the Grapefruit League. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the fact that I'm gone. It was a statement by Jeter about Georgia that got you.
Well, here's what I'm doing with taking my family to go see the Marlins. My daughter is 18 months old and she wasn't able to see the Marlins last year, so this is why she's able to see them now. I couldn't see them last year and she wasn't alive before then, so I went to go see the Marlins. I had options. The Florida Panthers are a very good team this season. They were playing at the exact same time, but I saw that statement and I was like, what the H, let me give some money to the Marlins and take my daughter to this ballpark that you built. And you know, some good, some bad.
Did you see any pictures of me anywhere?
No, I didn't see any pictures of you. I saw.
How was the home run sculpture? Did it go off? Did the Marlins? Let's start with this. Did they score?
I left after three innings. So, yeah.
Was it too long? Wait, tell me exactly. Was it you who wanted to leave, your wife or your daughter?
It's a combination of things. We got there early because I wanted my daughter to just run around the park and have free reign of the place and tire herself out. So we got there about an hour before first pitch. And, you know, it's a lot. I am enjoying the spacing that the social distance allows for, because she was marching up and down that aisle. It was interesting. Logistically speaking, I'm not exactly sure why they closed certain concession stands in the name of social distancing just to have everybody that's there converge upon three that are centrally located. It seems counterintuitive to me. Also, is everything coming out of the same kitchen?
So, yes, except there's certain concession stands where there is cooking that happens, but there's also a main kitchen. And when you're asking about the strategy of which seats get closed or where the Lone Depot Park tarps go, it's all done purposefully. And they're doing exactly what we would have done when we closed the upper deck. Now it's harder to close the upper deck because of social distancing, but they tarp sort of the ends. And we built such a small ballpark that one day when the Marlins get good, and it may be this year, and full fans, full capacity is allowed back, how people can enjoy Marlins games the way they enjoyed World Baseball Classic games. Because when that ballpark is full, it is some kind of exciting.
I don't know if it's because it takes me back to tremendous memories that I had going to getting fish tank seats and running around and getting better seats because there was nobody in the stands. But this may shock you, especially considering all the work that you put into the stadium. You know where I'm going. I enjoy the games at Dolphin Stadium more than I enjoy them at this ballpark. The ballpark just, it doesn't quite, I don't have any memories attached to it. Maybe that's why, but I miss the old stadium.
Well, you may be the only one. I think that what I miss about Dolphin Stadium may be the location, because it was certainly easier for me to get to as a former Broward guy. But I also can tell you that Dolphin Stadium presented so many logistical problems for us because it was a football stadium that was retrofitted by Wayne Huizenga when he owned the Dolphins and then bought the Marlins, or started the Marlins, founded the Marlins. And his first love was always the Dolphins, because from a business standpoint, he thought that was his best chance for the best return on his investment, and he turned out to be correct. And so we were fighting elements all the time and fighting with the Dolphins employees all the time, fighting with the stadium operations employees all the time, because we felt like the ugly stepchild all the time. And it just drove me crazy. You know, meeting with the grounds crew every day can get very boring.
Yeah, that's right. Let's talk about the grounds crew, because you guys had unique challenges. I'm sure you had all the vitriol from the Dolphins because of the infield dirt. There were two teams in the NFL that had infield dirt. How much shit did the Dolphins give you guys, and how did it work the other way? Because I'm sure you guys didn't have the greatest of time sharing that pitch with the Dolphins.
So we each, I like that you said pitch. That's good. That's the Chelsea. Is that the Chelsea in you? That sounds so snobby when you say it when we're talking about U.S. sports. Am I the only one who thinks that? Chris, where are you? He said pitch.
He's backing me up.
It's a baseball field.
It's a field. It was a multi-purpose pitch.
It's not. There was no pitch.
Yeah.
The only pitch was the mound, which, by the way, went up and down. I don't know if you know that.
I've heard that. So the baseball mound has been, wait, this is, are you saying it has like a mechanical lift to it?
No, they would lose the mound, right?
Yeah.
It's a thing that it's like construction that would happen. If you've ever watched a football field turn into a baseball field, it's sort of fascinating what they did. The left field bleachers, which are the sideline for Dolphins games, those were bleachers that would get pushed in left field. So if you go back and look at video from your time at Dolphin Stadium or Pro Player or Landshark or Joe Robbie, that where the out-of-town teal scoreboard was, by the way, that's a relic of the past. You don't need out-of-town scoreboards anymore at all. But that was a great out-of-town scoreboard. But all of the bleachers there would get pushed back. And my fear always is that fans who are sitting out there were going to fall over. Because I don't know if you realize, if you sat out there in left field, the front row of the left field bleachers was not really a front row. It was the last row before the bleachers below it got pushed in.
Yeah.
So there was nothing in front of you.
I would hold my breath every time Derek Lee hit something into the Publix Power Alley, because it did seem precarious a little bit. And I went there for one of the Marlins Giants playoff games. And I was in the upper deck, not in the Derek Lee Power Alley, as I called it. And Jeff Conan, I think, made a really good catch on a Barry Bonds fly ball, and I couldn't see it at all because it happened below me. I couldn't see the action.
Yeah, there were lots of sight issues. One of the things when we were designing Marlins Park was trying to make sure that all the seats, do you know when you design a park and seats are slanted, and do you know what the focal point is on a baseball field? What's your guess? Where would you want the seats all facing toward?
Batter's box.
So no, it faces a few feet between the pitcher's mound and home plate, but a few feet away from the pitcher's mound is where you want all seats facing.
Okay.
That is total physics. It's total architectural design. But every seat at Marlins Park, if you look at it, it's all facing in one place, one focal point. Dolphin Stadium did not have that, so the sight lines were troubling, to say the least.
What kind of shit did the Dolphins give you about the pitch?
They carried the lease, and I carried the lease in my black bag. And in the lease just was everything related to how sponsorship dollars worked, because they own the sponsorship rights to the majority of the signage. And what they would call it is non-baseball signage. So we tried to get as much baseball signage as possible, which is outfield wall. But anything above where during a Dolphins game, that would be a sign also, we didn't get one penny from that. and they got categories that they got to have that were their own that we couldn't sell on the outfield wall. So if they had Budweiser in Dolphin Stadium, we couldn't do a deal with Miller and put a sign on the outfield wall. And so we were constantly arguing because they would make up that they had these sponsorship deals with people and they would sign them to below market deals, you know, for a dollar that they're exclusive. And therefore we got totally screwed and they would just do everything they could. It was unbearable, but it's one of the reasons that Marlins Park happened is the fact that Wayne Huizenga then gave the lease to Stephen Ross. And Stephen Ross was even worse than Wayne Huizenga. And so I carried around a letter with me from Stephen Ross, which said, you guys got to go. We're not renewing your lease. No more extensions. Either get yourself a ballpark or get the hell out of town. See you later. And I used that negotiating with the public to get Marlins Park done.
Because that carried more weight and the threat of you guys leaving was more real. Makes sense. What was your first meeting with Stephen Ross like? Was it contentious from the jump?
No, I had met him before, and he was far more interested in the Dolphins, and he had no interest in the Marlins at all. He had this vision of what pro player or whatever it was called when he took over, and his vision was such that the Marlins were just in the way. So he made it very clear from the first moment that we were like a gnat. And he said, I really don't care about any of your rental revenue or any of the shared revenue that we get from you, and because they shared a lot of revenue. I just want you guys out. So can I help you get a stadium? And I said, of course you can. Would you like to invest in the Marlins?
Wow.
Because at a valuation, let's pretend a valuation of $300 million. Why don't you come in and we'll take that money and we'll put that toward the public-private partnership. And if you would help us politically, that'd be great. And he did nothing. As a matter of fact, once we got the ballpark and he saw that we were able to get a deal done that he couldn't get done, he changed his tack. And the Dolphins became famous under Steve Ross and a guy who's still there named Tom Garfinkel. They actually, a former executive for the Padres, remember when he and Mike D switched places?
Yeah. So was that a trade?
No, it was a bizarre change. It was like 13 going on 30. All of a sudden, they just were two people changing positions. And they were very loud when it came to telling politicians and telling fans in Florida that what they're trying to do with Dolphin Stadium, they're not going to do it the Marlins way. They're not going to take public money. They're not going to try. And guess what? Of course they get public money, but they just used the Marlins as a shield as they went and did their deal with Miami-Dade County.
For better or worse, and more likely worse, your legacy with that stadium is... It was kind of the tipping point, certainly locally, but also nationally in terms of publicly funded stadiums. You guys were the point of no return. How do you feel about that legacy?
I don't think that is my entire legacy. I think my legacy is still being written, but I think that certainly if my legacy ends up being in terms of stadiums that we were the last ballpark to get funded the way we did because we were able to cut such a good deal, I'm not sure that that's such a bad legacy because so many people don't want public financing. Billy Corbin should call me and thank me because if we are the last stadium deal that gets done the way ours got done and he's so against stadium public financing, why wouldn't he send me like a Passover card or a thank you card, something?
Yeah, you're going to be brought in on every interview because you were the last one. It's like every time there's an anniversary of the Titanic, they're just going to wheel out one survivor. Are there any survivors of the Titanic still with us? David Sampson with us here. That's interesting. Stephen Ross actually probably made a bad business deal by passing on that investment because he would have recouped his money tenfold.
Yeah, by the time he started negotiating, because he was a player to buy the Marlins when they were being sold in 17 or 16 and 17. And when we told Ross, I went to meet with him and with Garfinkel and said, here's what the price of the team is. And he had an interest at that time in cornering the market on sports teams. And he just was not interested at the price point that I was interested at. And so he decided to pass. But I didn't tell anyone that he passed until he and eventually leaked the fact that he passed. We did that with the Arisons too, right?
Yeah.
They all leaked that they passed because they didn't want to hear anymore around town that they were in the market for it because I needed them to be in the market for it. I wanted them to be in the market for it because the more bidders, the better. So I wasn't going to leak the fact that they thought that we were asking $500 to $700 million too much. Because they're smart businessmen.
Yeah.
So I knew that Ross and Arison were not buying the team, but I just needed them to pretend they were buying the team for long enough for Derek and A-Rod to stay in the game.
And it was bizarrely good PR to just come out and announce, hey, we're not in on the Marlins. It was, you're nodding your head yes. That's kind of weird. By the way, the last living survivor of the Titanic disaster passed away in 2009. I imagine that was Gloria Stewart or something. We move on. Stephen Ross has very ambitious plans for Hard Rock Stadium. We always see these concepts. He wanted a water park. At times there were signs for a water park, and now there's sky lifts, and obviously the tennis complex is there. There's designs for a moat and an F1 track. Does he get all of this done? How kooky of ambition does Stephen Ross have in terms of that plot of real estate?
Remember, not only does he pay taxes on that real estate, but also any revenue he gets is non-football related revenue. So that's all his money. In addition, he has incentives with Miami-Dade County that are public. You can go look at the agreements that the more events that he brings to, what is it called now? Hard Rock.
Hard Rock.
The more events that he brings to Hard Rock, the more money he gets from your county. So he is well incentivized to do as much as he can. The water park, my recollection, was Wayne Huizenga's idea, not Stephen Ross's idea.
Do you kind of snicker when you see these teams volunteering their stadiums as vaccine distribution sites and testing sites? Because there's obviously something in it for them. Now, some of these stadiums may be fully publicly funded and they have no say in the matter because this is centrally located. For all the reasons we built it for you, it's a great place for a testing site. But I can't help but think, well, there's got to be a quid pro quo here, a favor for a favor.
Do you know one of the things that we negotiated in the Marlins Park deal is that we would not allow it to be a hurricane shelter? And that was a huge bone of contention for us.
That seems really cold.
Well, okay. Say how, label it how you want it.
It does. Let's just say the optics of having what in, and I know you're going to push back on the notion that it was publicly funded, but taxpayer dollars, even if it's tourist dollars, helping go into a building and for it to not be able to be of use for displaced people during a natural disaster is very bad optics. Joel Osteen had to suffer through this, and that was a private enterprise.
So what we agreed to is that the parking lots and the area around the ballpark, like the West Plaza and East Plaza, that can be used for distribution. It can be used for staging. And we did allow the ballpark to be used for staging during all sorts of hurricane issues and other issues that would happen in Miami-Dade. No problem at all. The issue we had is that with people, remember what happened? You know, you can make fun of me all you want. Do you remember what happened in New Orleans at the Superdome?
Yeah.
After Katrina, when it became a shelter?
Yeah. It's one of the enduring images of that disaster, Hurricane Katrina.
And that's not something that we wanted at Marlins Park. And that doesn't make me bad. It doesn't make me wrong. It doesn't make me Machiavellian. It means that we did not want to take a ballpark that had such a huge investment by the public and by the private sector and have it become a long-term solution should there ever be a disaster like Katrina.
Can I ask you to elaborate a little bit more? Because, look, I don't want to, in part, I'm trying to avoid stepping into it, but the optics of that, like, that was also like a racial crisis in New Orleans, the people that were displaced by
this
it.
This is not about race.
Okay.
Let me be very clear.
Yeah, so
this
I'm asking you to elaborate because someone can hear what you're saying and process it as, is David speaking in code?
No, I'm not. Thank you very much. If anyone thinks I'm speaking in code, then you don't get the show. I don't speak in code. I tell you exactly what went on, the exact negotiation, the exact reasoning behind it, because I'm okay to have my blinds up. I'm okay for people to hear what actually went on in my head during negotiation. It had nothing to do with race at all. It had to do with the amount of time and then the amount of problems that would be caused by having long-term residents live in a place that's not meant to be lived in. And then who is going to pay to get it back to the condition it needs to be in order to have baseball?
Marlins Park is a vaccine site, or at least a testing site, last I checked. I guess it's okay for that. But back to my original question, is this a favor for a favor?
Everything in the negotiation was a favor for a favor. So when we say there's certain hills that you're willing to die on and certain hills that you're not. And having the ballpark not be a shelter, the county didn't push back enough to say, this is the hill we're going to die on. Changing the name to Miami, they did push back and said, that's a hill we'll die on because we need to be known as Miami.
And you've gone and into detail in previous episodes, hey, you were always going to change the name to Miami, but this was a bargaining tactic.
And that's all it is. And that's why you don't ever tell the other side what you're doing, because you have to hold it back so you can release one thing at a time during the course of a negotiation. You don't ever, ever show your cards. That's the expression, right? Why would I? But in terms of a shelter for a hurricane shelter, remember, that's a big deal in Miami, is what's going to happen if there's another Andrew or a larger, a worse Andrew. I don't know. Is Katrina considered worse than Andrew?
Yes.
I actually don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. I the only hesitation there was because Katrina did hit South Florida before it actually hit New Orleans. So I was trying to decipher what you meant. But yeah, Katrina's, I think, the biggest hurricane disaster, the most costly hurricane disaster, although the one in Houston was pretty big. Amin, what do you have here?
Semantics, but Katrina, the hurricane wasn't as bad. It just hit the levees and the levees flooded and all the other stuff that happened as a result of Katrina, as opposed to, I think, Andrew and even the one that happened, he's a hurricane, I can't remember the one in Houston's name, but those ones were actual hurricane damage as opposed to this was kind of secondary.
I think even Superstorm Sandy was probably more costly than Hurricane Andrew. Hurricane Andrew, for as powerful as it was a very small hurricane. It was just really
powerful. But it has a very long-standing, large legacy. It's something that when I moved to Florida, I didn't think about because I didn't. All I knew about Andrew is I saw it on the news when I was young.
Haunting. I was like five years old. I still hear the sound that storm generated and the sound of like bombs going off. As a little kid, it was a deeply terrifying moment.
So it was something that came up. It was on the list of issues to be discussed. So when you go into the stadium negotiation, you have 300 items that need to be talked about, that need to be somehow worked into a contract. And you just start going one at a time and you start sort of putting the puzzle together. It's really like collective bargaining. It's like any negotiation that you do. You get an issues list is generated. And then the issues list morphs into a smaller list of this is on your side, this is on my side. And then how do you possibly put together a deal where each side feels it's gotten a win on enough issues?
I've taken too long in getting to this point, which is pointing and laughing at David Sampson. Haha, you said that Major League Baseball wouldn't dare move the All-Star game because it was too tough. And I tried to point out that, hey, look, the NBA has done this twice in the last 5 years. And David, MLB moves the All-Star game, something that you said probably wasn't going to happen. You reversed course.
I didn't say probably. I said they weren't.
I was trying to.
So have they announced that they've moved it yet or not? Is that official?
Last I read, Coors Field is the leader.
Just kidding.
Yeah.
Coors Field was named.
It was named?
I was wrong. Here's what happened. I was focused on two things. 2022 is the Dodgers. 2026 is the Phillies. And 23 to 25 have not been named where the All-Star games are going to be. What I wasn't focused on is that there were teams which were preparing bids for the 2023 to 25 All-Star game, the way we prepared for the 17 All-Star game with a bid back in 2012 when the ballpark opened is when we started trying to get the All-Star game in 17. And what I didn't properly focus on is that there were cities that were already working to host. And when you work to host, it means you're doing deals with hotels, you're doing deals with convention centers, you're working on logistics, you're getting financing from the local and even from the state. And I didn't realize that Colorado was so far down the road. So what Rob did, he didn't choose Colorado because of voting laws. He didn't choose it because of the mountain time zone or the beautiful fact that marijuana is legal. None of that came into account. What came into account is Colorado said, okay, we've prepared all of this already. We're just going to change the dates on the contracts with the hotels, change the dates on everything to now, and we'll get ready. And the second piece that happened is the mayor and the legislature in Denver agreed to put budget money toward the All-Star game for now, not waiting for years from now.
What do you make of Republican leadership now using Major League Baseball as a pawn in this culture war that's going on? And the anti-cancel culture folks are now the first in line to cancel folks. What do you make of all of this?
It's the boycotting of the boycotting, right? We're going to boycott MLB for boycotting Georgia. So it really is becoming somewhat alarming that there is a question that companies have to ask themselves every day now, which is what position are we going to take on a particular issue? Some issues, you shouldn't have to think about what position you're taking. the issues of sexual harassment, the issues of racism, the issues of equality. You don't need to think about those. When it comes to voting rights bills and bills in general, you better make sure you've done your homework and done the reading. I am not in favor of voter suppression at all, obviously. I want everyone to have the right to vote because it's critical. That is exactly what a democracy is. However, I'm going to be very careful not to have a knee-jerk reaction to anything because what I've learned by my time in Washington, there's so much going on in a particular bill that you better make sure you read it before you say anything. And baseball just got put in a position where there was nothing they could do because their players said to them, we're not going. You can keep the game in Atlanta. We're not even going to read the bill. We've read what we think people are saying it's about, but we're not playing. And that put Rob in a position where he had no choice.
Major League Baseball was slow in reacting to George Floyd. Did they learn their lesson from that? Because they acted pretty swiftly here, considering the logistical hurdles they had to clear.
You know, we talk about this a lot in PR, which is it better to be first or last? And the answer is it's better to be early but right. So you don't have to be first, but you shouldn't wait either too long where I think didn't Jeter do a statement like 9 days after something or 10 days after something happened? And we commented on this show that it was a great statement, but it just seemed late. And it was something with stop Asian hate is what was that issue that day. And that's the other thing that I think about all the time is these issues keep popping up and then you go on to the next issue and it's like people forget about the last issue. Like with Katrina, you raise money and help New Orleans, but then there's another natural disaster and people forget about the fact that New Orleans is still suffering, or it happens in Haiti all the time or in Florida or anywhere. But you just don't want to be late. And what MLB did here is they took the exact right amount of time. It wasn't knee-jerk. They got their ducks in a row before they made the decision. They heard from players that they were going to boycott the game. And then they just came out and made a definitive decision. So I respect what they did. I didn't think they'd get it done. But I also didn't think the players would say they wouldn't play.
It could be accused of grandstanding, no, because the All-Star Game is an exhibition, ultimately. Teams aren't going to stop traveling to Atlanta. That's still going to be a revenue stream for Atlanta. So why the separation of home series at the Braves' current stadium, which also has a sordid past, and the Major League All-Star Game as an example?
Because people have a view that regular season games are your right, but jewel events are your privilege. And so what baseball said is we are not going to give Georgia any privilege. And that's why they pulled the All-Star game. But of course, they're not impacting regular season games. And by the way, in the history of my time in baseball, shocking the owners who came out against Rob, Ken Kendrick and his statements, you wouldn't see that when Bud Selig was commissioner. An owner coming out and saying so clearly how against he is something that the commissioner has done. The Braves with their statement, while MLB was involved in that statement, knew that statement was coming out. It's pretty telling that the Braves released the statement they did, but I was more shocked by what Ken Kendrick did, the owner of the Diamondbacks.
Well, you have to look at Ken Kendrick's motivations, right? Arizona, a hotbed for sociopolitical conversation often, and I'm sure he's not thrilled about the precedent of having an All-Star game ripped away from you. It was sort of like while the public was unified in anti-Donald Sterling sentiment, Mark Cuban's over there waving his hands like, hey, this is probably dangerous. We shouldn't maybe take away his entire team for this. We should set some rules. So a little bit of that going on there with Ken Kendrick.
One of the thing that owners fear more than life itself is someone taking away their franchise. That's all. I had several jobs as president of the Marlins. The first one was to make sure that baseball wouldn't take away our franchise, which is why I got involved in contraction with the Expos, because there was a risk of the franchise being taken away. It's why in Florida had to make sure we had a place to play, because the rule is if you don't have a place to play, your franchise can be taken away. So you have to, there's a set of rules as a franchisee that you have to abide by. It's like being a In-N-Out franchise and saying, we're not going to use potatoes. You know, there's a rule. You got to use potatoes for the fries and show people that you're peeling them and using them. So I kept very copious track of everything that needed to happen, but you're damn right. It's very dangerous when a group comes together to take away a franchise because the next day they could be coming for yours.
Hey, David, I didn't know if you saw this the other day. The Texas Rangers now are allowing maximum capacity in their park. I get it. Texas has kind of looser COVID protocol laws than the rest of the union. But how likely do you think this is going to sweep the nation, if you will, either in baseball or in other sports?
As quickly as possible. Texas had a real problem because they opened a new ballpark last year and they didn't get to, they had no fans in the stands until the championship series and the World Series. So they're a year behind. They built their team up to win last year. It didn't. Then they traded some players away. Can you imagine signing players going into your first year of a new stadium and then trading them before your second year of a new stadium? Who the hell would ever do that? Mikey, by the way, for those of you just listening at home, Mikey missed that entire thing because I just gave him a softball and he just totally missed it.
Yeah, well, we're actually, you're absolutely right. I'm trying to cultivate a next question here. So you caught me, David Sampson. But we were talking about Inter Miami, and in conversations with season ticket reps, their actual plan is to have limited capacity for the first three games and not necessarily wade into deeper waters. Cannonball, fourth game, full capacity crowd, which is very Florida of them. What do you make of that strategy? No slow burn here. Just, okay, we'll play ball for three games, but then jump in on the deep end. And way to call me out on that correctly.
So personally, I'm all into social distancing and wearing masks and getting vaccinated, but I'm way more into revenue. So the minute my government says I can have full capacity and I'm going to sell as many tickets as I can. However, being with the Marlins, I would have a different view from a PR standpoint.
Because you're never gonna have a full crowd there.
Bingo.
So you can grandstand.
Therefore, what you say is we are gonna wait until we are sure that it is safe for all fans to be in a ballpark. We believe it is in the best interest to have people sit in pods.
Bravo.
We believe that having certain concession stands closed matters. It's the greatest excuse ever, and I'm going to ride that until I can't ride it anymore.
That's beautiful stuff there, David Sampson. The voice of the fan, David Sampson, joins us here every week. Follow him at David P. Sampson. Every week he gives us a review of either a television event, a movie, a docuseries. What do you got going on this week, David Sampson?
I got a text from Dan. He said, watch Tina. And it had not been on my list.
I have got thoughts. I cannot wait. Go ahead, David.
So I put it on my list. And I need to get serious for a minute because I watched it. And what bothered me is that during the 80s, I'm a musical 80s baby. And I'm singing What's Love Got to Do With It and Private Dancer. And that's the music of my youth. And Beyond Thunderdome. And I was aware of the jokes that were made about Ike and Tina. I was aware of the joke in Wedding Crashers when Bradley Cooper is abusive toward Rachel McAdams and Owen Wilson says, hey, that's a little preview of life with Ike. And I laughed at it because I was ignorant about it. And I actually ex post facto feel like crap about it because watching this documentary and seeing the life that she had, I was only interested in the glory she had, the music, not aware of anything other than I'd heard that Ike Turner was a bad guy. And then you see this documentary and it made me sick. I felt so badly for Tina Turner. I'm so happy that she's happy now with a man who treats her right. I just find marital spousal abuse to be, it's beyond pale. It's just beyond. So the documentary was well worth seeing, guys, but the underlying story made me feel like crap.
David, had you never seen the movie What's Love Got to Do With It featuring Angela Bassett and Lawrence Fishburne?
Yeah, that's the angle that I want to approach it at too, because I turned this documentary off 10 minutes into it because I was like, I'd rather watch What's Love Got to Do With It.
Well, see, that's the funny thing, Mike. So first of all, David, absolutely put on your list. This is a great, great acting performances by both Lawrence Fishburne and Angela Bassett.
Incredible.
I mean, they are amazing. And it's one of those things where you watch a biopic and you say, oh, they're doing a great acting job of these characters, but how close is that to reality? Watching Tina made me realize, oh, wow, they really hit it on the nose. So definitely watch What's Love Got to Do With It if you haven't already. But the other part of it, Mike, is I felt bad in a different way. I felt bad because I saw What's Love Got to Do With It and I said, okay, Tina's basically showing us the real life stuff, which is very close. But then Tina goes into the stuff that happened after she left Ike and the racism and the resistance she encountered in the music industry. And I felt so bad. I said, you guys had a whole movie. You never even talked about guys calling her the N-word on a conference call. It blew my mind how much more she had to overcome after she left Ike Turner. The other part, Mike, and I'm curious to see if you think this. I thought they painted Ike Turner. They didn't run up the score on him.
Right.
They took pains to try to get like a full picture of the guy, even though he was a deplorable human being.
So I'm sorry, David. I checked out after 10 minutes because it made me want to watch What's Love Got to Do with It more. And I felt in those 10 minutes, I'm like, this is actually quite kind to Ike Turner. Yeah. Whereas What's Love Got to Do with It, it's more accurate and uncomfortably so. But now that you mentioned the other angles that they tackle Tina Turner's career on, I'm longing for that. I want to see that. But the first 15 minutes or so, the first part of her story, is I've seen this before and done better.
Yeah, it's a lot of rehashing.
Okay, David, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, rehashing, when it's a documentary, is it still called rehashing? And that's real, right?
I don't think
isn't
so.
The movie possibly?
Yeah, I don't think Ken Burns is presently rehashing Hemingway on PBS.
Right, exactly. So I would say that Ike Turner, when you say they didn't run up the score, I didn't have 1 ounce of sympathy for him. I had hatred for him. So what is running up the score past showing that someone is an abuser and an absolute, what is worse than beating your wife?
I guess by comparison, in this project, he's more sympathetic.
Yes, he's a more
by comparison, and that's how like dastardly.
I'll give you a great example, David. In the movie, he's just the worst parts of Ike Turner, right?
Yeah, he's a monster.
He's a monster. There's no explanation. That's just how Ike is. In the documentary, they take pains to talk about Ike's past and what led him, because the reality is very few people are just born monsters from the day they walked out the womb. Many people are created. They say hurt people hurt people, and they take the time to explain how Ike was hurt in his past that led him to be this kind of abusive person. That's something that if someone was making a documentary about my life and I was an executive producer on it, obviously I had creative control on it, I don't know that I would allow the big villains of my life to be viewed, I'm not even going to say sympathetically, but just give them a reasoning or a reason for being the way they are. And they did that. They didn't have to do that, but they did that.
Do you know, in the law, it's not a defense that you were abused, therefore you're an abuser. You saw murder. Your family was murdered, therefore you can murder. So I never even thought of that, that would make it sympathetic to show that he was abused and that's why he's an abuser, or he was hurt, that's why he's hurting. I've never given someone the benefit of that doubt, because that is not, we have to stop that. If we keep allowing people to act in a way that is not proper or moral simply because that's what behavior was modeled for them, I think we're going to have an endless string of crap.
So your full review on Tina is certainly watch this.
You have to. But now, by the way, I'm going to watch What's Love Got to Do with It, and I'll get to it this weekend for sure. And I will then review What's Love Got to Do with It next week. We'll talk about it again, because I'm fascinated by what you're saying. Is will watching that movie make me feel as though the documentary was not true to Ike? Or maybe the documentary was true to Ike and the movie was not true because they wanted more drama. They wanted him to be the monster because that'll sell more tickets.
You know, one of the things, I think the seminal things that happened in both the movie and the documentary, in the movie, she goes to work with Phil Spector. What's the name of that song, Mike? The one with the big orchestral sound?
You're putting me on the spot.
Yeah, okay.
Right now.
So, but regardless, she works on this thing, and Ike is very jealous that she is trying to go outside of the box that he's built of kind of Ike and Tina. And then it just sticks as a jealousy point. In the documentary, they talk about, yeah, he wasn't happy about it, but the song flopped. And then they show Ike explaining at the time why the song flopped. And it wasn't because, man, that guy doesn't know how to make music, or I told Tina this is the best thing. It was like an actual very reasoned explanation about how he said, look, here's the deal. In America, in order to get on the Billboard charts for a black artist, you have to do well on the R&B charts. Well, the problem is this song, while it's a great song, does not appeal to black radio stations and black DJs, so they won't play it. And because they won't play it, it won't rise on the black charts. And because it doesn't rise on the black charts, it won't play on the big Billboard charts. And so he said, basically, you made a song that the black DJs won't play and the white DJs won't play. And like, it, again, it was like, they didn't have to show that clip. They could have just said, and then Ike was jealous. But they showed it, and it was like, man, he actually makes a good point there. And it, I felt myself kind of, it just wasn't the same kind of monster that he was in the movie.
River Deep Mountain High, thank you, Chris Whittingham, for doing the research on that, is the name of the song. It got me thinking, it's one of those standout movies in which you have two actors of repute. Like, these are tremendous actors of their time, delivering what, for my money, is each of their best performances in their illustrious careers. It doesn't happen all that often when you think about it. Pulp Fiction comes to mind. I think that's the role that Travolta will always be remembered for, and perhaps, well, Kill Bill maybe for Uma Thurman, but Uma Thurman was great in that movie. What movies kind of stick out to you in which you're getting multiple actors to deliver their best performances of their career in one film?
I'm thinking about Rain Man right now. That just came to my mind because of Dustin Hoffman and Tom
Cruise,
and sort of that performance and how young Tom Cruise was during that movie is staggering to me.
Have you seen Mission Impossible Rogue Nation?
I've seen every Mission Impossible. Yeah. I love, we've talked about this
on
the show.
Yeah, it's the best action franchise.
I love Tom Cruise.
Right, but I think maybe Rogue Nation is his best performance, but we're parsing.
Yeah, don't. If you're going to say that, then I could go the scene with Nicole Kidman and Eyes Wide Shut, right? I mean, so there's different scenes. Risky Business with Rebecca De Mornay was a good scene for him, too.
Yeah,
so there's some good moments.
But the fight, the bathroom fight scene against Henry Cavill, I think, is...
I concur.
Can we go back to something? Lawrence Fishburne...
They're covering it at Juilliard, I think. Someone did their thesis on it.
Are you saying that they're the best performance of that time... because they're old or because we're old? Do people today, does your audience not know Lawrence Fishburne?
No, I think they know him as Morpheus. Yeah, I actually just saw The Matrix. Still holds up, by the way. I mean, the graphics are a little, it's a little antiquated, but for the time, I have to remind myself, this was made in 1999, and we're going to review on Cinephobe, a movie that was made just 2 years prior, and boy, CGI came a long way in those 2 years. But David, I'm not doing that with Lawrence Fishburne. I'm just speaking to the truth that the performances and What's Love Got to Do with It is just, they're just so spectacular from Angela Bassett and Lawrence Fishburne.
I'm excited to watch it, but I know it's going to be a tough watch. I have problems with watching movies like that. I do it. They're not horror movies. I don't watch horror movies, but movies that show that type of abuse. I had problems with The Accused. I am so uncomfortable with that. Boys Don't Cry comes to mind as an uncomfortable watch.
Silence of the Lambs, one of those movies where you have two great actors delivering the performances that they might most be remembered by.
David, I want to brace yourself. It is extremely graphic, and the thing that makes, that gives you a chill inside yourself while you're watching is, this ain't fiction, baby. This is real life. And because you've watched the documentary, you're going to see, like, oh, they didn't have to dance up any of this stuff. This is as true to the original story as you're going to get out of biopic.
I hope that I hope people are listening. I hope people pay attention. I actually talked about this on Nothing Personal yesterday, maybe, talking about that there's certain things that that are just not acceptable, period. It has nothing to do with color, race, age, size, nothing. Hitting a woman is just a never. There's nothing that could ever happen. There's no fight big enough. There's no anger you could have toward a wife or a girlfriend or a friend that is great enough. That I find that sort of abuse and spousal abuse, that is the third rail for me. And it just, so watching it, and I'm going to watch it now. You're forcing me to watch it. I'm just not pleased about it.
Yeah, it's been a bizarrely hard sell on a movie from, when was that movie made? 1993, 94?
1993, What's Love Got to Do with It?
Incredible. Yeah, I remember watching that movie for the first time. I remember where I was, and I was like, man, I was like 7 years old or something like that, and it just stays
with
you.
What were you doing watching that movie at seven?
What were you doing at seven having BET on? They used to play that thing on BET every weekend.
Yeah, I would watch 106 and Park and BET Uncut on BET when I was when I was 4 years old. It was amazing. Yeah. David, thank you so much. Oh, I got one question about Jazz Chisholm Jr. This kid wants it. He wants to be a star. It was very exciting. I haven't seen Lone Depot Park erupt that way in my entire life when Jazz Chisholm in one series sold two bases and scored on a sacrifice fly to shallow right field. It was amazing. Lone Depot Park erupted. Scenes.
How many games have you been to at Marlins Park or Lone Depot Park?
I went to the first one ever. I think I went to a Cubs game. I went to a Pirates game in which a relief pitcher I thought was hitting on my wife, but was just trying to tell me he got the show while I was at the Clevelander. I was like legitimately about to fight a Pittsburgh Pirates reliever because I'm like, why does this guy keep looking over here? the hell is his problem? And he like calls me and my wife over. I'm like, oh, it's on. I'm going to have to fight a Pittsburgh Pirates reliever. And he's just
was he in the bullpen?
Yeah.
Was he in the bullpen?
He was in the bullpen.
So we built that bullpen. So here's a, but he was just we had the home show. Bullpen. Sorry to interrupt, but this is funny because it never would have happened if Marlins players in 2012 wouldn't have complained. The home bullpen was the Clevelander bullpen when the ballpark started. And we wanted our fans in the Clevelander to see Marlins players. But Ozzie Guillen came up to us and said, this isn't going to work because my bullpen is too busy staring at the people in the Clevelander. So put the road team there. We're getting out. And so I didn't want to move. I didn't want to move bullpens. I said, tell your players to focus more. But Jeffrey did not let me win that. And so then it became the visiting team bullpen.
Was quite the diversionary tactic. Yeah. And there was a lot going on in that Clevelander. It's actually ridiculous when you look back on it. The body painting, there was stuff going on in that Clevelander that was not going on in any other major league ballpark in recorded history.
So we never told Major League Baseball about the body painting, the nudity that was going to happen because they have to, MLB goes, does a site visit for a new ballpark and they have to approve everything. They approve the design, then they approve it along the way. They're approving on field, off field. And they saw the pool and then they figured it was going to be like Arizona because we said, yeah, it's going to be like Arizona. People will be there hanging out. No problem. It'll be like Tampa. We may put some Devil Rays in the tank. No worries at all. Meanwhile, get a call after the Clevelander opens from Bud. Is that body paint I see? I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. I said, no, that's their uniform. It's the Clevelander. That's just a bar in South Beach. It's no big deal at all. Is that body paint? I said, Bud, listen, I'm not out there. I'm working. I don't go there.
And you just swept it under the rug and it kept going until only recently where it's no longer the Clevelander. I think it's just an empty space now. It's sad. I really love that Clevelander portion of the ballpark.
Yeah, the new ownership group did not want the Clevelander.
It's a shame. David, thank you so much for joining us. Really enjoyed this week's episode. Make sure to support David Sampson in his endeavors. Nothing personal. That podcast does quite well. And follow David Sampson at David P. Sampson on Twitter. Dan has just stumbled in. I think he has a question for you here, David.
It's just how I imagine Disney people, like you said, Bud, right? It was Bud Selig. It's how I imagine Disney people when they would come down here to the Clevelander and see that everyone's ass was hanging out of their shorts. And I just imagine Disney people being like, how did this get here? How was this allowed? Why is this here? This isn't Disney. We let go of Paul Pierce for having exotic dancers in his room. And every weekend, Monday morning out here, you have that writhing by the pool.
And hence, you're not at ESPN anymore.
Oh, but it was a good run. It was a good
it was
run.
A hell of a run.
A hell of a run, baby.
All right, everybody. Mother's Day is officially around the corner. If mom's gift isn't already on the way, you've got hours, maybe even minutes, to get it together. So head over to 1-800-Flowers.com right this second. 1-800-Flowers still has great last-minute deals on handmade bouquets, sweet treats, gourmet food, and one-of-a-kind gifts ordered easily and delivered fresh. You want to get mom something that shows your appreciation for all that she's done? We know you've been a knucklehead. She knows you've been a knucklehead. Please do better. Help your mom feel appreciated this Mother's Day. This is your last chance to lock in these Mother's Day deals. Only good while supplies last. Order today at 1-800-Flowers.com/Dan, D-A-N. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/Dan.